Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 9 of the 11 suspects in that alleged Russian spy ring face bail hearings today in federal courts in New York, Alexandria, Virginia, and here in Boston. The 10th defendant, that glamorous New York real estate agent Anna Chapman, was already denied bail, and the 11th suspect, Christopher Metsos, jumped bail, which is sure to figure into today's hearings. Metsos was arrested in Cyprus after U.S. authorities claimed he shuttled back and forth between Moscow and the U.S. and served as the group's primary contact with the Russian government. After he paid his $32,000 or so in bail, he disappeared like a spy. James Gordon Meek is national security correspondent for the New York Daily News. James, this story continues to have sort of a moose and squirrel, you know, Boris and Natasha comic strip feel to it. You write about a bar where all spies, you know, have long hung out. We want to hear about that. But what are you hearing about the seriousness of this affair?
Well, thanks for having me on,
yeah,
Robin.
No
it's
problem.
Good to be with you. There is some ambiguity that the Justice Department prosecutors have not laid out everything they know, which is pretty typical when they first make arrests and file criminal complaints, as they have in this case. So I'm sure there's a lot that we don't know about, right. But they put out about 60 pages that detail, you know, a pretty extensive narrative of the FBI very recently and going back a decade following this group of people. It's almost a dozen of these so-called illegals, and these are you know, we call them sleeper agents, but the idea is that they're Russians who are trained to behave as if they are Americans or they're immigrants from someplace other than Russia, like Germany or Canada or Switzerland, and blend into American society, collect some intelligence of some sort, and also possibly be there if they ever needed to be activated for some other purpose.
Right, and in the writings we're reading, we're hearing potentially nuclear information or policy information, but I just want to pick up on something you've said.
Yeah.
You quote a retired ex-KGB chief. He was ex-chief in the U.S., he retired now. He's surprised that these were these deep cover spies as opposed to what? Or alleged spies, as opposed to spies who posed as diplomats?
Well, here's the thing. Every, you know, major country that has a spy service, there are two types of spies. There are people who work in foreign countries under official cover, and there are those who work under non-official cover. And if you're under official cover, then you have diplomatic immunity. In other words, if you get caught doing anything, then you say diplomatic immunity, and they ship you home. In the case of people who are working under non-official cover, we call them NOCs in the CIA. These are people who do not operate under, do not carry a diplomatic passport or any kind of immunity. Mm. They can be tried, they can be shot, executed, and a number of CIA officers have been throughout its history caught and executed or imprisoned for decades in some countries. So
some serious consequences. And I just want to jump in.
Pretty much.
And, yeah, you quote.
So these people are not claiming diplomatic immunity.
Right,
they're illegals. That's their own term.
Right. Well, you quote Ronald Kessler, who's written extensively about the CIA, saying that that somebody might have developed this kind of network to impress their boss with a caper. But I just want to hear from you. You also write about how this spy versus spy game has been playing out for decades in places like Jay Gilbert's. This is a legendary watering hole where you say Russian spies have gotten jobs to sort of eavesdrop on the CIA agents who are there. And then the FBI also, you know, they get jobs there or they come in and drink there to keep an eye on both the spies and the CIA agents.
Yes. It's kind of a weird place. It used to be called Charlie's Place. Some of the Iran-Contra deals were cut there between Ollie North and former Director Casey. But because there are a number of establishments in McLean, Virginia, which is where the CIA headquarters has been for the last, you know, 40-some years, you know, it's always been known. I grew up there, and it was always part of the sort of local lore that the places where the CIA people frequented were also there were always Russian or, and when I was growing up, Soviet spies who would take jobs bartending, waiting tables, whatever, customers to keep tabs on folks from Langley who were there, see who was in town, who was not in town, just sort of general, you know, surveillance activity. And the FBI knew this, so the FBI counterintelligence division would have their own people working there, patronizing the place to keep, as you said, keep tabs on both the Russians and the CIA people to make sure there were no unauthorized contacts there. So it was always kind of a weird thing. You go to this place, and there are lots of legitimate customers, obviously, and it's Jay Gilbert's has fantastic steaks. But you just you never really know who's a real customer and who's actually working.
Well, again, as you said, James Gordon Meek, we don't know the seriousness of the charges. We're going to hear more as it unfolds, and so we'll touch back with you at that time. James Gordon Meek, national security correspondent for the New York Daily News. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, some recent press reports about Rwanda caught our attention. Pictures of an American professor jailed for representing a Hutu opposition leader. Uh-oh. We know the Hutus brutally slaughtered Tutsis in the Rwandan genocide of 1994. Now a Tutsi, Paul Kagame, is leading the country. So does this power shift mean that the former victims are now oppressing their former oppressors ahead of new presidential elections in August? This week, that Hutu opposition leader represented by American Peter Erlander was told she couldn't run for office because she denies the genocide. Erlander was jailed for 3 weeks and says the government tried to make him disappear. A journalist who was critical of the Rwandan government was killed earlier this month, as was a dissident former general. So what is going on in Rwanda more than 15 years after the genocide? Philip Gurevich is staff writer for The New Yorker. He's also author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families, his extraordinary book about the Rwandan genocide. He's working on another book. He's just returned from Rwanda and joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Philip, welcome.
Good to be with you.
And let's remind ourselves, Kagame came into office in 2000 but was in the government since the genocide ended in 1994. He is a Tutsi, and again, the Tutsis were, suffered at the hands of the Hutus in the genocide. So let's get right to it. Is the opposition right? They're saying that this is just a flip of power, and we're now seeing the Tutsis abusing the Hutus.
That's an absurdly simplistic reduction of the story. The most obvious answer is that there isn't, because there isn't the systematic attempt to exterminate Hutus. There may be a power shift where the power of state is held by a Tutsi, but any Rwandan, nobody who's really paying close attention would describe Kagame or his regime as the Tutsis. They are certainly primarily Tutsi group, but there are Tutsis who oppose them. There are Tutsis who do not feel properly represented by them. There are Hutus who work with them. There are Hutus who think very well of them. There was a Gallup poll that came out that described 62% of the population. Now, you have to understand, Rwanda's population is still 85% Hutu, as having an optimistic economic view of their prospects for their village, their region, and their nation. That doesn't mean they all love the government, but it certainly means that it's a complex picture there. I mean, when they shuttered two newspapers earlier this spring, you saw quotes from human rights groups and press freedom groups saying the muzzling of the Hutu voice in Rwanda will inevitably lead to a return to violence. Guess what? Those papers weren't run by Hutus. They were Tutsis. And so there's an attempt by critics of the regime to presume a kind of ethnic bias and to warn of violence at every single step. Honestly, the genocide and its immediate aftermath were a much simpler time to understand Rwanda. You had this very clear crime that had happened, but as things become complicated afterwards, as power shifts around, it's so tangled there. It's so tangled. I was hearing stories last month of survivors who were married to Interahamwe militia members who were active in the genocide. That's how tangled it is.
Well, so we hear you saying that you don't think that this is just sort of reverse abuse, Tutsi against Hutu, but is it abuse of power? I mean, Karina Turksakian, a researcher at Human Rights Watch, told the AP that Rwanda is a country where there's not much freedom of expression, but in the months leading up to the August elections, we really have seen a further crackdown on any form of opposition, dissent, or criticism. Some are characterizing it as getting worse.
I have to say that I just didn't see a whole lot of it before. Mm-hmm. So the whole notion that there's a crackdown on it, what it is this is the kind of occasion when oppositionists are going to get a hearing for these things. A lot of these opposition parties that say that they're being repressed and that we're seeing a spike in repression, they weren't really allowed to operate all that freely before. So I think that what you see is a country that is not in any sense an open democracy, and elections show just how much it's limited. That hasn't changed. It just comes to the fore when somebody comes back from exile and tries to use the occasion of an election to get the world's attention. much of what is being written from outside, and most of the writing about Rwanda is being written by people who aren't going there, is saying that Rwanda's big fracture line right now is Hutu-Tutsi, as it always has been, and that the Hutus have been muzzled and that they don't have a voice. And it is true that there isn't a kind of Hutu voice as such in Rwanda. You're not supposed to express yourself in terms of ethnic competition. But in fact, the worrying tension-creating fault lines in the political system there right now are mostly following tensions within the military and political ruling structures. There are generals who have gone into exile, mostly, as far as I can tell, over personal and accountability issues within the hierarchy. Some of this actually seems like McChrystal kind of issues, generals who don't respect the civilian command or are accused of not respecting it. And let's talk very specifically about who these oppositionists are, because the woman, Victoire Ingabire, had lived in exile since before the 1994 genocide. And since at least 2000, she was the president of a party called the RDR, which was founded by the former regime perpetrators of the genocide in the camps in Zaire, now Congo, after the genocide. In other words, this was a group of exiled people either involved in or closely connected to those who had perpetrated the genocide, who created the RDR in the mid-90s to become the group that would fight for the return to power of the people who had the genocidal ideology. Mm-hmm. And now they're known as the FDLR, the military wing. Her group, she's still the president of that group. She's been linked with by a UN report to connections with those people. That doesn't criminalize her necessarily, but in Rwanda, there are very strict laws about these things. When she arrived in the country, she immediately confronted and provoked a challenge to those laws by going to the genocide memorial for Tutsis and saying, well, there was essentially systematic massacres of Hutus who haven't been given a hearing. And the symbolism, as much as the statements of where she said this, she went to genocide prisoners, people convicted of genocide, and she said, I've come to free you. And she discredited the trials against them. And the regime arrested her. And right now, she stands accused broadly of some kind of genocide denial, and they say the case is even stronger for collaboration with outside enemy forces. Those are serious charges, and simply to take them as if they were a gimmick for suppressing dissent is a mistake.
Well, Rwanda also wouldn't be the only country to not allow Holocaust denying. You know, it's against the law in Germany as well.
It's against the law in most countries in Europe, and it is forms of divisionist speech or ethnically provocative speech are outlawed in many, many African countries. These speech laws are often remarkably broad, and they only come to our attention when they're applied.
That's reporter Philip Gurevich. If you just joined us, he's saying charges that the survivors of the 1994 genocide, the Tutsis, are now oppressing the Hutus who perpetrated the genocide. Those charges are untrue. They're being made by genocide deniers. We're going to have more with Philip. Also, later today, the American librarian who's taken it upon herself to keep track of deaths in the Mexican drug war, and pianist Fred Hirsch, still to come today. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with New Yorker writer Philip Gurevich, author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, his exquisite book about the Rwandan genocide in 1994. And we asked Philip to join us because recently there have been reports that the government that evolved after that genocide has been cracking down on opposition candidates ahead of the presidential elections in August. And so we wondered if the Tutsi victims of the genocide, now led by President Paul Kagame, were now turning on their former oppressors, the Hutus. But Philip says, hold on, it's much more complicated than that. He says the divisions aren't as much Hutu-Tutsi anymore as they are within the ruling party and within the military. And also, despite the flawed democracy in Rwanda, there have been improvements, which he wrote about in a New Yorker article. But Philip Gurevich, you've also had your critics who say maybe you're just too admiring of President Paul Kagame. There's a blog, Mondo Weiss, it's associated with The Nation. Writer James North says that your article about progress in Rwanda could have been written by the government. He compares you to an unreconstructed communist or a Zionist, a backer of Israel, who can't recognize that his heroes, and by that he means Kagame, who was once seen as leading his country out of genocide, that hero is now flawed. Your thoughts?
From the beginning, I've described Kagame's path to power as bathed in blood. I've described him as ruthless and the activities that he's taken in order to bring order to the country as ruthless. I've been quite often said that it's clearly not a country that one would call a democracy, but that the only way to understand the country is to spend a great deal of time there and to try to think about what exactly it means to try to recover from a genocide. Now, many of these people don't want to acknowledge that, or they want to equate the fact that there was a civil war and that there was violence used in bringing the country to order after the genocide as simply the equivalent of genocide. To say that the election in Rwanda is not an open, democratic election of the kind that we're accustomed to is an obvious fact. That's all I'm saying that I think is different from people who say it's a massive escalation of repression.
Well, and how would you characterize Kagame? I just want to be sure we're hearing you clearly. You seem to say he's been sort of carrying on a sort of business as usual, but is there also something heroic about what he's trying to do, keeping that country together? I mean, how would you characterize him?
You know, the way I would characterize it is that at this point, there are many people who are sure that they know who Kagame is. He tends to be painted as either some sort of messianic figure because he led the army that stopped the genocide. But there were a lot of other people around him who were responsible for whatever you may credit them with and whatever you may blame them for. But I want to say something very important here. If one wants to try to understand where Kagame's going with all of this, some people say they know for sure that he's, you know, the diabolical dictator of Africa. And others say he's clearly the messianic leader who sets an example for all of Africa. I think neither of those ways of looking at it is either realistic and therefore helpful. What I do think is he's at the end of a constitutionally allowed first 7-year term. I think what you have to take into consideration in trying to understand what's happening with the coming election is that nobody's had any doubt about what the outcome would be. President Kagame is due for a second term if reelected, and nobody doubts that he would be reelected. The question was always more, how's it going to go? In 2017, his elected time would be up. If he leaves office at that point and is able to lead some kind of a peaceful and coherent transition of power, a lot of the things that he's blamed for, I think, will be seen in the perspective of somebody who did a very statesmanlike thing and left power, which is a very rare thing in Africa. And I think that if he holds on to power, a lot of the good that he's done will be seen in that light.
Well, and you detail that good. And again, we remind ourselves, this is a country post-genocide in which people have to live right next door to people who killed their family members. So it would seem almost an impossible situation. And you write, reconciliation is progressing. Rwanda is one of the safest and most orderly countries. Per capita national income has nearly tripled. National health insurance. Plastic bags are outlawed to reduce litter and protect the environment. A long list. And in fact, former President Clinton presented Kagame with a Global Citizen Award last fall, praising him for freeing the minds of his people.
If you were in Rwanda, as I was, in the immediate aftermath of the genocide, nobody at that time could have imagined that the country would look as it does today and function as it does today and have growth as it does today and be basically a place where people live together. And at the same time, the article that you're referring to where I revisited the country last year, I think I made it extremely clear that it was an extremely fragile balance there and that much that was torn apart in the first place remains only minimally put back together. And then unfortunately, a great deal of what one sees there that goes for reconciliation is really just coexistence and is government imposed. This is not what the government of Rwanda would write, contrary to this blogger that you brought up. It is what one finds when one reports, which is, I speak to a man who is a confessed killer and he tells me that he enjoyed it. He tells me that up to a couple of years ago, just before he was confessed, he was in prison dreaming that his comrades would come and liberate them and they would finish the job. That's somebody who's now a model citizen who has confessed and been released and reintegrated into society. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people convicted of these crimes are living again at liberty, integrated into a society. And that society is fragile. And it's in that context that the competition for power has to be understood, how very fragile it is, that that conflict didn't end in 1994 when the government of Kagame took power. It didn't end in 1997 when the first war in Congo brought the majority of people back from the refugee camps. It doesn't end now. There are armed forces determined to go after that and to disrupt that peace, and who would like nothing more than to see Kagame and his government fail in order that catastrophe could ensue. And I think one must distinguish between criticisms of that government that are voiced by people who have some hope and interest in Rwanda's well-being and those who, in a sense, wish to see catastrophe ensue or recklessly invite that possibility.
Phil Gurevich, staff writer for The New Yorker, also author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families, his book about the Rwandan genocide. Philip, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the new film Restrepo looks at a platoon in Afghanistan's Korangal Valley.
The colonel told me they take fire every single day. How the hell do you take fire every single day from somebody? You got to go out there and go kill the damn enemy. Quit being scared.
We'll speak with a soldier in that film. Also, 4th of July means family reunions, but is yours getting a mayoral proclamation? That's tomorrow. Still to come, this guy, pianist Fred Hirsch, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England, and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We got a peek at unemployment numbers today. The big report comes out tomorrow, but today's shows jobless claims unexpectedly rose last week by 13,000. The Labor Department says increased layoffs in construction and annual summer education layoffs, along with temporary census workers now losing their jobs, contributed to that rise. So that's the newly unemployed. But meanwhile, Congress is debating if and how to extend unemployment benefits for the 9 million plus Americans already collecting. Without that extension, 200,000 people lose their weekly checks as their claims expire every week. Well, one of the 9 million currently unemployed is Norm Elrod. He's a marketing professional in New York. He's been laid off four times in the last 9 years. He writes the blog Jobless and Less, the blog for the unemploymentally challenged. So, Norm, first of all, your thoughts on the extension debate. A University of Chicago economist, Casey Mulligan, is one of many who says a large fraction of unemployed people delay going back to work just because they keep getting unemployment benefits, that the program essentially pays them not to work. And so he says, don't extend them. Your thoughts?
Well, unemployment benefits don't actually cover most people's expenses. So, I mean, I'm able to get in New York the highest amount, which is $430, and that is much less than I was making when I had a job, and it doesn't cover my expenses. Mm. So maybe it makes it a little easier to be unemployed and look for a job, but it doesn't make me want to be unemployed and just sit on the couch.
Well, former House Speaker Tom DeLay also weighed on this. He said people are unemployed because they want to be, and you said what in response on your blog?
The Tom DeLay is stupid because he wants to be.
But so you, I mean, obviously this is a thinking that rubs you the wrong way. You said about $430 a week in benefits. How much did you used to make?
I used to make an annual salary of $70,000, which when you break it down a lot more than $430 a week, it was probably more like $800 to $900 a week.
And you've told us that one of the reasons that you're even surviving is that your wife has health insurance, so you're on that.
Mm-hmm.
You do some freelancing. How does that work? Did you go on and off unemployment?
Exactly. I take on projects and don't claim unemployment for those weeks. But when I don't have projects, then you claim unemployment. I've been fortunate to have a project that's gone on for a little while now, but I'm still on the unemployment rolls. So when it ends, I'm hoping to go back on.
And what are some of the issues that this brings up? What do you write about on your blog?
Well, I write about whatever is affecting me personally. There are a lot of sites out there that cover how to find a job or how to do a resume, but I wanted to talk about what the experience of being unemployed is like, all the problems and the situations that come up. And just frankly, that feeling of not being as productive as you would like, and the feeling of uselessness and worthlessness sometimes that comes about with sending out a ton of resumes and not getting any response.
Then I'm going to stop you there, because when you mention resumes, you say you've learned that employers might weed through stacks of resumes and eliminate those of the unemployed?
Yes, that's something I read recently, that is one of the criteria that a lot of employers use to thin out the pile, is they assume that there's a reason you're unemployed and that reason is bad and they can eliminate you from consideration.
Yeah, and also taxes, just trying to do your taxes?
Yeah, doing your taxes, I mean, it's always a bit of an adventure, but this past time when I did it, I noticed just how little money I'd earned the previous year, and the feeling that gives you of, I spent this whole year, 2009, looking for work and trying to be productive, and at the end of the day, I didn't earn all that much money, but I put in just as much, if not more, work than I did during a year where I was fully employed.
And you pay taxes on it.
And I pay taxes on it. It's a job, being unemployed.
Have you thought of changing careers?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Part of creating the blog was teaching myself how to manage a website and how to do more online marketing, so I can hopefully move my career more in that direction, because I noticed within the realm of marketing that online marketing is one of the areas that stayed relatively strong.
Well, I hope that this is a big darn job interview for you.
I hope so.
That's Norm Elrod, who writes the Jobless and Less blog. We'll link you at our website, hereandnow.org, helping us see a little bit inside the world of the unemployed. Norm, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, your thoughts about this or any story, go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there, hereandnow.org. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. Mexican officials are saying this Sunday's election will go ahead despite the drug-related assassination earlier this week of a gubernatorial candidate, one of the 23,000 Mexicans killed since 2006 when President Felipe Calderon began his war against the drug cartels, a war that's being followed closely in El Paso, Texas, where stray bullets hit City Hall on Tuesday, possibly from right across the border in Ciudad Juarez. That's Mexico's deadliest city, but no official death toll is kept there. Well, one American has made it her personal mission to document the killings and post the tally online. Molly Malloy is a librarian at New Mexico State University. She reports that 17 people were killed in Ciudad Juarez yesterday, including a decapitated man who was dumped in front of the home of a mayoral candidate. Molly, you are in Las Cruces, New Mexico. That's about 50 miles north of Juarez. So why is this compilation important to you?
It's important to me because I have not seen reliable information in any other source. As part of my job, I monitor a lot of different Mexican media, and I find that the daily stories on the homicides, the murders, are really only reported in the local Juarez media. And so what I try to do is to monitor that and provide brief summaries, sometimes translations of entire articles, if I think that they're important. And so far, I find that the numbers I have maintained tend to be more accurate than anything I see reported in the English language press that we read in our country, and also in English language papers in Europe, for instance.
Well, why do you think that is? Do you think that it's foot-dragging on the part of journalists or officials in Juarez, or fears that the cartel will target them? Why do you think it can't be more accurate?
I think it's more a situation where everyone involved in this is overwhelmed. I believe that the Mexican authorities actually have a hard time keeping track themselves. Yeah. For instance, here's an example recently. The Juarez paper reported that there were 265 people murdered in Juarez the month of June. The article goes on to sort of parse this a little bit, saying that the federal authorities say that these deaths are mostly related to organized crime. And in the Mexican press, that's sort of a code for saying that the federal attorney general's office has jurisdiction in these cases. And so the cases will be investigated by the federal authority. At the same time, the Mexican newspaper, the El Diario from Juarez, can't get official numbers from the federal attorney general as to how many crimes they are investigating. I think that that kind of obfuscation is part of what's going on. I think part of it is intentional. I think part of it is just that the Mexican government is overwhelmed. There was an article in a national newspaper in Mexico a few weeks ago that said 95% of these murders, meaning the 23,000-plus murders nationwide, are not being investigated. They're basically in limbo.
So are you saying, in part, it's that they're overwhelmed, and it's part, you know, once you call it a drug-related crime, it has to be investigated, and so there may be some hesitancy to do that because they're overwhelmed. So there's all these different reasons why we just don't have the number.
That's right. In general, in Mexico, it is very, very difficult to get real information on how crime is both investigated and resolved. And so for Mexicans, sadly, this situation is not that unusual. The main thing that's unusual about it during the last 3 years is the quantity, the huge, the overwhelming number of people being killed. And so the U.S. press seems to deal with this fact by always underestimating the numbers. I can give you one example. I spoke at a little conference last week. And at that conference, I gave the latest, fairly specific data that I had, that there were had been 5,700-plus murders in the city of Juarez since January 2008. Another person who followed me on the panel said that there had been 5,500. That's 200 people missing. And you may think that it's not a huge number of people left out of the count, except when you consider that those are 200 human beings who have been murdered. And interestingly enough, in the years before this terrible outbreak of violence started happening in 2008, the murders in Juarez ranged generally between 200 and 300 each year. And so the missing 200 is more than some of the annual numbers. It's just a way to get an idea of the order of magnitude in a city that's, as you say, 50 miles from where I live and only a five-minute walk from the nearest large city in the United States, which is El Paso, Texas.
Well, and you don't do just statistics on your daily compilation. You do essays, for instance, one I remember reading, yeah, about women who have been killed, and you sort of tell their stories by way of not just making it an accurate number but making it more than a number.
To do that because that almost never appears in our press unless it's a very spectacular event like the 19 people killed at a drug rehab center in the city of Chihuahua a few weeks ago. If we could do that for every single article, we would have the most evidence to counter the Mexican government's continual argument that all of these people or 90% of these people killed in this so-called war are criminals being killed by other criminals. And two girls aged 14 and 15 were killed. Two women driving a pickup truck were attacked, and one of them was shot to death. The other one was injured. The car crashed into another car and killed another person. I cannot, for the life of me, figure out how the Mexican government can just say out of the blue that these were criminals, especially since there's no investigation.
Well, and, you know, we want to put that in perspective. The Wall Street Journal had a graphic recently comparing homicides in Mexico to homicides in major American cities. And you had to add up all the homicides in eight cities, New York, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Houston, Baltimore, and New Orleans, to equal the homicides last year in Juarez. Again, 2,600 just in Juarez. And Juarez, about the same size as Philadelphia, which had 302 homicides last year. Again, a terrible number, but compared to 2,600.
It's truly astounding when you look at that kind of comparison. And I think that unless we confront the actual truth as much as we possibly can as to what is going on there and what is behind this violence, there's no possible way for us to contribute to a solution.
That's Molly Malloy, librarian at New Mexico State University, who's taken it upon herself to tally the number of dead as a result of the drug wars in neighboring Juarez, Mexico. Molly, thanks so much for telling us about your work.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed talking with you.
Okay. And before we go today, a master class with jazz man Fred Hirsch. That's in about 1 minute. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back. Jazz pianist and composer Fred Hirsch has had a remarkable career, starting as a sideman for Joe Henderson and Stan Getz over 30 years ago. Since then, he's performed to great acclaim, but also Fred Hirsch has taught at his alma mater, the New England Conservatory of Music. And when we caught up with him there last semester, Fred Hirsch invited Here and Now's George Hicks to a piano lesson.
At 8:30 in the morning, the practice rooms atop New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall are already filling up. This is not a congenial hour for a jazz musician, but Fred Hirsch is already here, starting off a full day of teaching with a group lesson.
Hey.
Good morning, Fred.
Yes.
Good to see you.
All right. Hey, Evan.
Come on in.
Gus Carnes, Luke Morantz, and Evan Allen squeeze in behind a pair of grand pianos. They're freshmen at the conservatory, among the best young American jazz pianists, and they're here to perform for a master.
So, who wants to play? Gus, you were here first.
Sure.
What do you feel like playing today?
Panonica.
Oh, good. Good choice.
Thelonious Monk's Panonica is also a brave choice, given that Fred Hirsch has made a specialty of Monk's music in his own solo performances. While Carnes plays, Hirsch sits motionless, head down, eyes closed. He wasn't much older than these students when he began teaching.
You know, I had to kind of learn how to teach. When I moved to New York in 1977, some people sought me out for some private lessons, even though I was a youngster. But by then, I was playing with Joe Henderson and Art Farmer, and, you know, I was kind of on the scene. And so at least I could talk to students from some position of credibility.
And as soon as Carnes finishes playing, Hirsch is ready with specific suggestions.
Okay. Tunes like this, there are a lot of details.
Right.
I think you could get into those details maybe a little more.
Yeah, okay.
If you're, say, using some contrary motion.
Hirsch scoots onto the bench to demonstrate.
Like here. This left-hand stuff is fine, but if you want to do that, you can also support it with the lower part of the right hand. Just to add a little more, like, stuff underneath and vary the rhythms a lot. Solid with the melody, which might mean, you know, transposing it.
Yeah,
you can also do it in the left hand.
These young players aren't just getting piano pointers. They're gaining insight into Fred Hirsch's own concepts of musicianship.
I teach from a pretty holistic place. Scales and patterns and all that kind of stuff, they can get in a book. I don't deal with that. What I'm dealing with is the quality of the music and what it means to be an artist and what it means to be a pianist. Respecting rhythm and melody and harmony in a deeper way, you know, not just good enough, but really challenging them to come up with it. Mm-hmm. That'll help. But I'd like to see you, you know, think more than just accompaniment, single line.
Yeah.
You know, I think you should keep working on it. It's a great tune.
Okay.
It's good. So what do you got, Luke?
I think I'm going to play How Deep Is the Ocean.
Luke Morantz is determined to keep a relaxed feel in this Irving Berlin tune. He says that until studying with Hirsch, he never had to play so much in a piano lesson.
I feel like every week I kind of like obsess about like what I'm going to play. And so I took a slightly different approach I just came in and tried to kind of play something that I felt comfortable with, and then I really try to work out all this stuff.
Hirsch's comments to Marantz reflect both Hirsch's holistic approach to playing and his insistence upon accuracy.
Okay. The hands look a lot better. Do you feel more relaxed when you're playing?
Feel more relaxed.
Once again, I kind of wish you were using your foot and were moving a little bit more on the seat. Another thing is, you know, really knowing the melody cold, which was a little suspicious. It doesn't have this A. Mm. If you know the words, you would never play that. You know, how much do I love you? I'll tell you no lies. How deep is the ocean? That's how it goes. I can always tell when a pianist is playing that doesn't really know the melody. So I tell students, well, if you're going to learn a standard, learn the words. That way when you play the theme, you can sing them in your head while you play. And it may give you access to a certain emotion in the composition. So, you know, details, they're really important. I mean, you don't want to get totally bogged down in them, but, you know, it makes for a more convincing performance. Okay? Want to play some of it?
Yeah.
Evan Allen chooses Stella by Starlight, imbuing this standard with unusual harmonies. He says Hirsch isn't a jazz teacher, he's a piano teacher.
It's really a combination of what he's been telling us about the way you approach the piano and the way you sit down and how you move your body and how that affects our performance, along with, you know, how you actually approach what you're doing. Every choice you make in your improvisation or how you approach a melody and how well you know the lyrics, it's all important.
It's no surprise to learn that this is how Hirsch himself has been taught.
I've been really blessed to have the same piano teacher myself for the last 28 years, Sofia Rosoff. She's now 89 years old, and I see her regularly. And her whole philosophy of the mechanics of piano playing and posture and where sound comes from and where rhythm comes from has profoundly influenced everything that I do. It's been like this love affair. So now the principles that I've learned from her, I talk about with my jazz students, and I've applied it with a slightly different accent.
In the prime of his career at the age of 54, Fred Hirsch stays busy with concerts, festivals, club dates, recording sessions, new collaborations, composing. So you might wonder why he comes to Boston from New York to teach 2 days a week.
I mean, I'm motivated as a teacher because I learned jazz in an oral tradition. The older players that I played with, you know, they taught by example or they taught by actually talking to me. Now they don't exist. So I feel that the schools have replaced the bandstand as places where the oral tradition is passed down. This is my way of giving back to those musicians that gave me so much. You know, it's for them that I do this.
Jazz pianist Fred Hirsch. His new CD is Whirl. He spoke with Here Now's George Hicks. And before we go, what is this warm, fuzzy feeling I'm having? I believe it's the presence of old friends. We want to welcome back listeners to OPB, Oregon Public Broadcasting. We're thrilled to follow your terrific show, Think Out Loud, which is sometimes a problem when I do it, but great when you do. Anyway, welcome and thank you. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what this week brings here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.